was more than she could bear. She had to confront him, had to get it into the open, had to find out. How? She asked herself. That was the question. Could she discuss it with someone at Hopkins? A psychiatrist, perhaps? Get professional advice? And risk having it get out? Risk having her shame widely known? Carolyn Ryan, associate professor. Pretty, bright Kathy Ryan can't even hold on to her own husband. What do you suppose she did wrong? Her friends would whisper when she was elsewhere. Sure, they'd all say that it couldn't be her fault, but then they'd pause and look embarrassed, and after a moment they'd wonder aloud what she might have done differently, why she hadn't noticed the signals, because after all, a failed marriage was rarely the work of a single partner, and Jack wasn't really the sort to play around, was he? The embarrassment of it would be worse than anything in her life, she thought, forgetting for the moment times that had been far worse. It didn't make any sense. But she didn't know what to do about it, though at the same time she knew that doing nothing was probably the worst thing of all. Was it all a trap? Did she have any choices at all? What's the matter, Mommy? Sally asked, a Barbie in her hands. Nothing, honey. Just leave Mommy alone for a little while, okay? Jack says he's sorry, and can he come out of his room? Yes. If he promises to be good. Okay. Sally ran out of the room. Was it that simple? Kathy wondered. She could forgive him almost anything. Could she forgive him this? Not because she would want to forgive him. Because there was more to it than her pride. There were also the kids. And kids needed a father, even a neglectful one. Was her pride more important than their needs? The other side of that. What sort of household would they have if Mom and Dad didn't get along? Wasn't that even more destructive? After all, she could always find another Jack. She started crying again. She cried for herself, for her own inability to make a decision, for the injury to her character. It was the sort of weeping that did nothing for the problem except make it worse. Part wanted him gone. Part wanted him back. No part knew what to do.
You understand that this is strictly confidential, the investigator said rather than asked. The man before him was short and overweight, with soft pink hands. The Bismarck mustache was obviously an affectation to make him look manly. In fact, he didn't look terribly impressive at all unless you took a close look at his face. Those dark eyes didn't miss a thing.
Doctors are accustomed to confidentiality, Bernie Katz replied, handing the credentials back. Make it fast. I have rounds in 20 minutes.
The investigator thought that his assignment did have a certain elegance to it, though he wasn't sure that he approved. The problem was that playing around wasn't exactly a felony, though it did usually disqualify a man from a high security clearance. After all, if a man could break a promise made in a church, then why not one made merely of paper?
Bernie Katz leaned back, waiting as patiently as he was able, which wasn't very patient. He was a surgeon, accustomed to doing things and making his own decisions, not waiting for others. One hand twirled at his mustache as he rocked in the chair.
How well do you know Dr. Carolyn Ryan?
Kathy?
I've worked with her on and off for 11 years. What can you tell me about her?
She's a brilliant surgeon, technically speaking. Exceptional judgment, superbly skilled. She's one of the best instructors we have on staff. She's also a good friend. What seems to be the problem here?
Katz's eyes narrowed on his visitor.
Sorry, I'm the guy asking the questions.
Yeah, I can tell.
Get on with it, Katz said coldly, examining the man, watching body language, expression, demeanor. He didn't like what he saw.
Has she made any comments lately? I mean, trouble at home, that sort of thing?
You do understand, I hope, that I am a physician, and things said to me are privileged.
Is Kathy Ryan your patient? The man asked.
I've examined her in the past. We all do that here.
Are you a psychiatrist?
Katz nearly growled back in answer. Like most surgeons, he had a temper.
You know the answer to that.
The investigator looked up from his notes and spoke matter-of-factly.
In that case, privilege does not apply.
Now could you answer the question, please?
No.
No what?
No, she has made no such comments to the best of my knowledge.
Comments on her husband? His behavior? Changes in the way he's acting?
No. I know Jack pretty well, too. I really like the guy. He's evidently a good husband. They have two great kids, and you know the story on what happened to them some years back as well as I do, right?
Correct. But people change.
Not them.
Katz's comment had the finality of a death sentence.
You seem quite certain.
I'm a doctor. I live by my judgment. What you are alleging is crap.
I'm alleging nothing, the investigator said, knowing it was a lie. And knowing that Katz knew it for a lie. He judged the man correctly from the first moment.
Katz was a hot-headed, passionate man, unlikely to keep any secret he deemed unworthy of being kept. Probably one hell of a doctor, too.
I return to my original question. Has Carolyn Ryan acted in any way different from, say, a year ago?
She's a year older. They have kids. The kids are growing up, and kids can be a bother. I have a few of my own.
Okay, so she's gained a pound or two, maybe. Not a bad thing. She tries to be too thin. And she's a little tireder than she ought to be. She has a long commute, and work is hard here, especially for a mother with kids.
That's all you think?
Hey, I'm an eye cutter, not a marriage counselor. Not my field.
Why did you say you're not a marriage counselor?
I never brought that up, did I?
Clever son of a bitch, aren't you? Katz thought, letting go of his mustache. Degree in psychology, maybe. More likely self-taught. Cops were pretty good at reading people. Reading me, even?
Trouble at home for a married person generally means a troubled marriage, Katz said slowly.
No, there has been no such comment.
You're sure?
Quite sure.
Okay. Thank you for your time, Dr. Katz. Sorry to have bothered you. He handed over a card. If you hear anything like that, I'd appreciate it if you called me.
What gives? Katz asked.
If you want my cooperation, I want an answer. I don't spy on people for the fun of it.
Doctor, her husband holds a very high and very sensitive government position. We routinely keep an eye on such people for reasons of national security. You do the same thing, even if you don't think much about it. If a surgeon shows up with liquor on his breath, for example, you take note of it, and you take action, correct?
That doesn't happen here, ever, Katz assured him.
But you would take note of such a thing if it did happen.
You bet we would.
Glad to hear it. As you know, John Ryan has access to all sorts of highly sensitive information. Were we not to keep an eye on such people, we would be irresponsible.
This is a highly sensitive matter, Dr. Katz.
I understand that.
We've had indications that her husband might be acting irregularly. We have to check that out. Understand?
We have to.
Okay.
That's all we ask.
Very well.
Thank you for your cooperation, sir. The investigator shook hands and left. Katz managed not to flush until the man was gone. He didn't really know Jack all that well. They'd met at parties perhaps 5 or 6 times, traded a few jokes, talked about baseball or the weather or maybe international relations. Jack had never begged off on an answer. Had never said I can't discuss that or anything. Pleasant enough guy, Bernie thought. A good father, by all accounts. But he didn't know the man at all. Katz did, however, know Kathy as well as he knew any other doctor. She was a thoroughly wonderful person. If one of his kids should ever need eye surgery, she was one of the three people in the world whom he would trust to do the fix, and that was the highest compliment he could pay to anyone. She'd backed him up on cases and procedures, and he had backed her up. When one needed advice, it was the other who got asked. They were friends and associates. If they'd ever decided to leave the Hopkins-Wilmer faculty, they would have set up an office together, because a medical partnership is even harder to maintain than a good marriage. He might have married her, Katz thought, if he'd had the chance. She would have been an easy girl to love. She had to be a good mother. She drew a disproportionate number of kids as patients, because in some cases the surgeon needed small hands, and hers were small, dainty, and supremely skillful. She lavished attention on her little patients. The floor nurses loved her for it. Everyone loved her, as a matter of fact. Her surgical team was extremely loyal to her. They didn't come any better than Kathy. Trouble at home? Jack's playing around behind her back? Hurting my friend? That worthless son of a bitch. He was late again, Kathy saw. After 9 this time, couldn't he ever get home at a decent hour? And if not, why not? Hi, Kath, he said on his way through to the bedroom. Sorry I'm late. When he was out of sight, she walked toward the closet and opened the door to check the coat. Nothing. He'd had it cleaned the very next day, claiming that it had been spotted. It had been spotted, Kathy remembered, but what to do? She almost started crying again. Kathy was back in her chair when Jack came through on his way toward the kitchen. He didn't notice the look, didn't notice the silence. His wife stayed in her place, not really seeing the television picture her eyes were fixed on, while her mind kept going over and over it, searching for an answer, but finding only more anger. She needed advice. She didn't want her marriage to end, did she? She could feel the process by which emotion and anger were taking over from reason and love. She knew that she ought to be worried about that, ought to resist the process, but she found herself unable to do either as the anger simply fed on itself. Kathy walked quietly into the kitchen and got herself a drink. She didn't have any procedures tomorrow. It was okay to have one drink. Again she looked over at her husband, and again he didn't notice. Didn't notice her? Why didn't he notice her? She'd put up with so much. Okay, the time they'd spent in England had been all right. She'd had a fairly good time teaching on staff at Guy's Hospital. It hadn't hurt her tenure at Hopkins a bit. But the other stuff... He was away so damned much. All that time back and forth to Russia when he was messed up with the arms treaty. So many other things, playing spy or something, leaving her at home with the kids, forcing her to lose time at work. She'd missed a couple of good procedures for that reason, when she'd been unable to get a sitter and had been forced to stick Bernie with something that she ought to have done. And what had Jack been up to all that time? She had once accepted the fact that she couldn't even ask. What had he been doing? Maybe having a good laugh? A little fling with some sultry female agent somewhere? Like in the movies. There he was, in some exotic setting, a quiet, darkly lit bar, having a meeting with some agent, and one thing might have led to another. Kathy settled back in front of the TV and gulped at her drink. She nearly sputtered it back out. She wasn't accustomed to drinking bourbon straight. This is all a mistake. It seemed as though there were a war within her mind, the forces of good on one side and the forces of evil on the other. Or was it the forces of naivete and those of reality? She didn't know, and she was too upset to judge. Well, it didn't matter for tonight, did it? She was having her period, and even if Jack had asked, which he wouldn't, she knew, she'd say no. Why should he ask if he was getting it somewhere else? Why should she say yes if he was? Why get the leavings? Why be second string?
She sipped more carefully at her drink this time. Need to get advice. Need to talk to somebody. But who? Maybe Bernie, she decided. She could trust Bernie. Soon as she got back. 2 days.
That takes care of the preliminaries.
Sure does, boss, the coach said.
How goes the Pentagon, Dennis? Not as much fun as you're having, Paul.
That's the choice, isn't it? Fun or importance?
Everybody all right?
Yes, sir. We're pretty healthy for this far into the season, and we have the bye this week to get everybody up to speed. I want another crack at those Vikings.
So do I, Secretary Bunker said from his E-ring office. Think we can really stop Tony Wills this time?
We can sure try. Isn't he one great kid? I haven't seen running like that since Gale Sayers. Defensing him is a bitch, though.
Let's not try to think too far ahead. I want to be in Denver in a few weeks.
We play him one at a time, Dennis, you know that. Just we don't know who we're playing yet. I'd prefer L.A. We can handle them easy enough, the coach thought. Then we'll probably have to handle Miami in the division game. That'll be harder, but we can do it.
I think so, too.
I have films to look at.
Fair enough. Just remember, one at a time.
But three more wins.
You tell the president to come on out to Denver. We'll be there to see him. This is San Diego's year. The Chargers go all the way.
Dubyanin watched the water invade the graving dock as the sluices were opened. Admiral Lunan was ready. The new sonar array was rolled up on its spool inside the teardrop-shaped fairing that sat atop the rudder post. The seven-bladed screw of manganese bronze had been inspected and polished. The hull was restored to full watertight integrity. His submarine was ready for sea, as was the crew. He'd gotten rid of 18 conscript sailors and replaced them with 18 new officers. The radical downsizing of the Soviet submarine fleet had eliminated a large number of officer billets. It would have been a waste of skilled manpower to return them to civilian life, besides which there were not enough jobs for them, and as a result they'd been retrained and assigned to the remaining submarines as technical experts. His sonar department would now be almost exclusively officers. Two Mishmanyi would assist with the maintenance, and all of them were genuine experts. Surprisingly, there was little grumbling among them. The Akula class had what was, for Soviet submarines, very comfortable accommodations, but more important than that was the fact that the new members of the wardroom had been fully briefed on their mission, and what the boat had done, probably done, Dubyanin corrected himself, on the previous cruise. It was the sort of thing that appealed to the sportsmen in them. This was, for the submariner, the ultimate test of skill. For that, they would do their best. Dubyanin would do the same. Pulling in a lot of old professional debts and leaning heavily on the yard's master shipwright, he'd performed miracles during the refit. Bedding had all been replaced. The ship had been scrubbed surgically clean and repainted with bright, airy colors. Dubyanin had worked with the local supply officers and obtained the best food he could find. A well-fed crew was a happy crew, and men responded to a commander who worked hard for them. That was the whole point of the new professional spirit in the Soviet Navy. Valentin Borisovich Dubyanin had learned his trade from the best teacher his Navy had ever had, and he was determined that he would be the new Marco Ramius. He had the best ship, had the best crew, and he would on this cruise set the standard for the Soviet Pacific Fleet. He would also have to be lucky, of course.
That's the hardware, Fromm said. From now on...
Yes, from now on we are assembling the actual device. I see you've changed the design somewhat.
Yes. Two tritium reservoirs. I prefer the shorter injection piping. Mechanically, it is no different. The timing is not critical, and the pressurization ensures that it will function properly.
Also makes loading the tritium easier, Gohn observed. That's why you did it.
Correct. The inside of the device made Gohn think of the half-assembled body of some alien airplane.
There was the delicacy and precision of aircraft parts, but the almost baffling configuration in which they were placed. Something from a science fiction movie, Gone thought, whimsical for a brief moment. But then this was science fiction, or had been until recently. The first public discussion of nuclear weapons had been in H.G. Wells, hadn't it? That hadn't been so long ago.
Commander, I saw your doctor, Ahmed said in the far corner.
And? You still look ill, my friend, Kadi noted. What is the problem?
He wants me to see another doctor in Damascus.
Kadi instantly did not like that. Did not like it at all. But Ahmed was a comrade who had served the movement for years. How could he say no to someone who had twice saved his life, once stopping a bullet himself to do so?
You know that what goes on here.
Commander, I will die before I speak of this place. Even though I know nothing of this project, I will die first.
There was no doubting the man. And Kadi knew what it was to be seriously ill at a young and healthy age. He could not deny the man medical care while he himself regularly visited a physician. How could his men respect him if he did such a thing?
Two men will go with you. I will select them.
Thank you, Commander. Please forgive my weakness.
Weakness?
Kadi grabbed the man by the shoulder.
You are the strongest among us. We need you back, and we need you healthy.
Go tomorrow.
Ahmed nodded and withdrew to another place, embarrassed and shamed by his illness. His commander, he knew, faced death. It had to be cancer. He had so often visited the physician. Whatever it was, the commander had not let it stop him. There was courage, he thought.
Break for the night, Gon asked.
Frome shook his head.
No, let's take another hour or two to assemble the explosive bed. We should be able to get part of it in place before we are too weary.
Both men looked up as Kadi approached.
Still on schedule.
Herr Kadi, whatever arrangements you have in mind, we will be ready a day early. Ibrahim saved us that day with his work on the explosives.
The German held one of the small hexagonal blocks. The squibs were already in place, the wire trailing off. Frome looked at the other two, then bent down, setting the first block in its nesting place. Frome made sure the block was exactly in place, then attached a numbered tag on the wire and draped it into a plastic tray that held a number of dividers, like the trays of a toolbox. Kadi attached the wire to a terminal, checking three times to make sure the number on the wire was the same as that on the terminal. Frome watched also. The process took 4 minutes. The electrical components had already been pre-tested. They could not be tested again. The first part of the bomb was now live.
Chapter 27, Data Fusion.
I've had my say, Bart, Jones said on the way to the airport. That bad?
The crew hates him. The training they just went through didn't help. Hey, I was there, okay? I was in with the sonar guys in the simulator, and he was there, and I wouldn't want to work for him. He almost yelled at me.
Oh? That surprised Mancuso.
Yeah. He said something that I didn't like. Something plain wrong, Skipper, and I called him on it. And you should have seen his reaction. Shit, I thought he'd have a stroke or something. And he was wrong, Bart. It was my tape. He was hassling his people for not queuing on something that wasn't there, okay? It was one of my trick tapes, and they saw that it was bogus, but he didn't, and he started raising hell. That's a good sonar department. He doesn't know how to use it, but he sure likes to kibitz like he does. Anyway, after he left, the guys started talking, okay? That isn't the only bunch he gives a hard time to. I hear the engineers are going nuts trying to keep this clown happy. Is it true they maxed an horse?
Mancuso nodded, despite the fact he didn't like hearing this.
They came within a whisker of setting a record. Well, the guy doesn't want a record. He wants a perfect.
He wants to redefine what perfect is. I'm telling you, man, if I was stuck on that boat, after the first cruise, the first thing up through the hatch would be my sea bag. I'd fucking desert before I worked for that guy.
Jones paused. He'd gone too far.
I caught the signal his XO gave you. I even thought he might have been a little out of line, maybe.
I was wrong. That's one very loyal XO. Rix hates one of his JOs. The kid does tracking party duty. The quartermaster who's breaking him in, Ensign Shaw, I think his name is, says he's a real good kid, but the skipper's riding him like a broke-down horse.
Great. What am I supposed to do about it?
Beats me, Bart. I retired as an E6, remember?
Relieve the son of a bitch, Jones thought, though he knew better. You could only relieve for cause.
I'll talk to him, Mancuso promised.
You know, I heard about skippers like that. Never did believe the stories.
Guess I got spoiled working for you, Dr. Jones observed as they approached the terminal.
You haven't changed a bit, you know that? You still listen when somebody talks at you.
You have to listen, Ron. You can't know it all yourself.
I got news. Not everyone knows that.
I got one more suggestion. Don't let him go hunting.
If I were in your position, I wouldn't.
Jones opened the door.
I don't want to rain on the parade, Skipper. That's my professional observation. He isn't up to the game. Rix is nothing near the captain you used to be.
Used to be. A singularly poor choice of words, Mancuso thought. But it was true. It was a hell of a lot easier to run a boat than to run a squadron. And a hell of a lot more fun, too.
Better hustle if you want to catch that flight.
Mancuso held out his hand.
Skipper, always a pleasure.
Mancuso watched him walk into the terminal. Jones had never once given him bad advice, and if anything, he'd gotten smarter. A pity he hadn't stayed in and gone for a commission.
That wasn't true, the Commodore thought next. Ron would have made one hell of a CO, but he would never have had a chance. The system didn't allow it, and that was that.
The driver headed back without being told, leaving Mancuso in his rear seat with his thoughts. The system hadn't changed enough. He'd come up the old way, power school, an engineer tour before he got command. There was too much engineering in the Navy, not enough leadership. He'd made the transition, as did most of the skippers. But not all. Too many people made it through who thought that other people were just numbers, machines to be fixed, things to order, who measured people by numbers that were more easily understood than real results. Jim Roselli wasn't like that. Neither was Bart Mancuso. But Harry Rix was.
So, now what the hell do I do?
First and foremost, he had no basis for relieving Rix. Had the story come from anyone except Jones, he would have dismissed it as personality clashes. Jones was too reliable an observer for that. Mancuso considered what he'd been told and matched it with the higher-than-usual rate of transfer requests, the rather equivocal words he'd heard from Dutch Claggett. The XO was in a very touchy spot, already selected for command. One bad word from Rix and he'd lose that. Against that possibility, he had his loyalty to the Navy. His job demanded loyalty to his CO even while the Navy demanded truth. It was an impossible position for Claggett. And he'd done all that he could. The responsibility was Mancuso's. He was the squadron commander. The boats were his. The skippers and crews were his. He raided the COs. That was it, wasn't it? But was it right? All he had was anecdotal information and coincidence. What if Jones was just pissed off at the guy? What if the transfer requests had just been a statistical blip?
Dodging the issue, Bart. They pay you to make the tough decisions. Ensigns and chiefs get the easy ones. Senior captains are supposed to know what to do.
That was one of the Navy's more entertaining fictions. Mancuso lifted his car phone.
I want Maine's XO in my office in 30 minutes.
Yes, sir, his yeoman responded. Mancuso closed his eyes and dozed for the rest of the ride. Nothing like a catnap to clear the mind. It had always worked on USS Dallas. Hospital food, Kathy thought. Even at Hopkins, it was still hospital food. There had to be a special school somewhere for hospital chefs. The curriculum would be devoted to eliminating whatever fresh ideas they had, along with any skills they might have with spices, knowledge of recipes. About the only thing they couldn't ruin was the jello. Bernie, I need some advice. What's the problem, Kath? He knew already what it had to be, just from the look on her face and the tone of her voice. He waited as sympathetically as he could. Kathy was a proud woman, as she had every right to be. This had to be dreadfully hard on her. It's Jack. The words came out rapidly, as though by a spasm, then stopped again. The pain Kat saw in her eyes was more than he could bear. You think he's... What? No. I mean... How... Why did you... Kathy, I'm not supposed to do this. But you're too important a friend for that. Screw the rules. Look, I had a guy in here last week asking about you and Jack. The hurt only got worse. What do you mean? Who was here? Where from? Government guy, some kind of investigator. Kathy, I'm sorry, but he asked me if there... If you had said anything about trouble at home. This guy was checking up on Jack, and he wanted to know if I knew anything that you were saying. What did you say? I told him I didn't know anything. I told him that you're one of the best people I know. You are, Kathy. You're not alone. You have friends, and if there is anything I can do, that any of us can do, to help you, we will help you. Kathy, you're like family. You're probably feeling very hurt, and you're probably feeling very embarrassed. That is stupid, Kathy. That is very stupid. You know it's stupid, don't you? Those pretty blue eyes were covered in tears, Kat saw, and in this moment he craved the chance to kill Jack Ryan. Maybe do it on a table with a very sharp, very small surgical knife. Kathy, being alone doesn't help. This is what friends are really for. You are not alone. I just can't believe it, Bernie. I just can't. Come on. Let's talk in my office, where it's private. Food's crummy today, anyway. Kat's got her out of there, and he was sure that no one noticed. 2 minutes later, they were in his private office. He moved a stack of case files from the only other chair and sat her in it. He's just been acting different lately. Do you really think it's possible that Jack is fooling around? It took half a minute. Kat's watched her eyes go up and down, finally staying down as she faced reality. It's possible. Yes. Bastard. Have you talked to him about it? Katz kept his voice low and reasonable, but not dispassionate. She needed a friend now, and friends had to share pain to be useful. A shake of the head. No, I don't know how. You know that you have to do that. Yeah. Not so much a word as a gasp. It's not going to be easy. Remember, Kat said with gentle hope in his voice, it could all be a mistake. Just some crazy misunderstanding. Which Bernie Katz didn't believe for a moment. She looked up, and her eyes were streaming now. Bernie? Is there something wrong with me? No. Katz managed not to shout. Kathy, if there's a better person in this hospital than you, goddamn if I've ever met them. There is nothing wrong with you. You hear me? Whatever the hell this is, it is not your fault. Bernie, I want another baby. I don't want to lose Jack. Then if you really think that, You have to win him back.
I can't. He isn't... He doesn't...
She broke down completely. Katz learned then and there that anger has few limits. Having to keep it in, being denied a target didn't help. But Kathy needed a friend more than she needed anything else.
Dutch, this whole conversation is off the record. Lieutenant Commander Claggett was instantly on guard.
As you say, Commodore.
Tell me about Captain Ricks.
Sir, he's my CO.
I'm aware of that, Dutch, Mancuso said. I'm the squadron commander. If there's a problem with one of my skippers, there's a problem with one of my boats. Those boats cost $1 billion a copy, and I have to know about the problems.
Is that clear, Commander?
Yes, sir.
Talk. That's an order.
Dutch Claggett sat ramrod straight and spoke rapidly.
Sir, he couldn't lead a 3-year-old to the crapper. He treats the troops like they're robots. He demands a lot, but he never praises even when the guy's put out. That's not the way I was taught to officer. He doesn't listen, sir. He doesn't listen to me, doesn't listen to the troops.
Okay, fine, he's the CO. He owns the boat, but a smart skipper listens.
That's the reason for the transfers?
Yes, sir.
He gave the chief torpedo man a bad time. I think he was wrong. Chief Getty was showing some initiative. He had the weapons online, he had his people well trained, but Captain Ricks didn't like the way he did it and came down on him. I counseled against it, but the CO didn't listen. So Getty put in for transfer, and the skipper was glad to get rid of him and endorsed it.
Do you have confidence in him? Mancuso asked.
Technically, he's very good. Engineering-wise, he's brilliant. He just doesn't know people, and he doesn't know tactics.
He told me he wants to prove otherwise.
Can he?
Sir, you're going too far now. I don't know that I have the right to answer that.
Mancuso knew it was true, but pressed on anyway.
You're supposed to be qualified for command, Dutch. Get used to making some hard calls.
Can he do it?
Yes, sir. We have a good boat and a good crew. What he can't do, the rest of us will do for him.
The Commodore nodded and went silent for a moment.
If you have any trouble with your next fit rep, I want to know about it.
I think you may be a better XO than he's entitled to, Commander.
Sir, he's not a bad guy. I hear he's a good father and all that. His wife's a sweetie. It's just that he never learned to handle people, and nobody ever bothered teaching him right. Despite that, he is a capable officer. If he'd only give an inch on the humanity side, he'd be a real star.
Are you comfortable with your op orders?
If we sniff out in a cooler to go in and track him, safe distance and all that.
Am I comfortable?
Hell yes.
Come on, Commodore. We're so quiet there's not a thing to worry about.
I was surprised Washington approved this thing and all, but that's bureaucratic stuff. The short version is anybody can drive this boat.
Okay. Maybe Captain Ricks isn't perfect. But unless our boat breaks, Popeye could do the mission.
They put the secondary assembly in before the primary. The collection of lithium compounds was contained in a metal cylinder roughly the size of a 105-millimeter artillery casing, 65 centimeters high and 11 centimeters in diameter. It even had a rim machined on the bottom end so that it would fit in exactly the right spot. There was a small curved tube at the bottom that attached to what would soon be the tritium reservoir. On the outside of the casing were the fins made of spent uranium-238. They looked like rows of thick black soda crackers, Frome thought. Their mission, of course, was to be immolated to plasma. Beneath the cylinder were the first bundles of soda straws. Even Frome was calling them that now, though they actually were not. They were of the wrong diameter. 60 centimeters in length, each bundle of 100 was held together by thin but strong plastic spacers, and the bottom of each had been given a half turn to make each bundle into a helix, a shape rather like that of a spiral staircase.
The hard part in this segment of the design was to arrange the helixes to nest together perfectly. Seemingly trivial, it had taken fully 2 days for Frum to figure out, but as with all aspects of his design, the pieces all fit into proper place until that portion of the design seemed a perfectly assembled mass of soda straws. It almost made the German laugh. With tape measure, micrometer, and an expert eye, gradation marks had been machined into many of the parts, a small detail that had impressed Gohn very greatly indeed. When Frohm was satisfied, they went on. First came the plastic foam blocks, each cut to precise specifications. They fit into the elliptical bomb case. Gohn and Frohm were now doing all the work. Slowly, carefully, they eased the first block into place within the flanges on the interior of the case. The straw bundles came next, one at a time, nesting perfectly with those immediately under them. At every step, both men stopped to check the work. Frohm and Gohn both checked the work, checked the plans, checked the work again, and checked the plans again. For Bach and Kati, watching a few meters away, it was the most tedious thing they had ever seen.
"The people who do this work in America and Russia must die of boredom," the German said quietly.
"Perhaps."
"Next bundle, number 36, Frohm said.
36, Gohn replied, examining the three tags on the next batch of 100 straws. "Bundle 36.
36, Frohm agreed, looking at the tags. He took it and maneuvered it into place. It fit perfectly, Kati saw, coming closer. The German's skilled hands moved it slightly so that the slits on its plastic jigs dropped into the slots on the jigs directly underneath. When Frohm was satisfied, Gohn looked.
"Correct position," Ibrahim said for what must have been the 100th time of the day.
"I agree," Frohm announced, and both men wired it firmly into place.
"Like assembling a gun," Kati whispered to Gunther as he walked away from the work table.
"No." Bach shook his head. "Worse than that. More like a child's toy." The two men looked at each other and started laughing.
"Enough of that," Frohm said in annoyance. "This is serious work. We need silence. Next bundle, number 37.
37, Gohn dutifully replied. Bach and Kati walked out of the room together.
"Watching a woman having a baby cannot be as dreadful as this," Kati raged when they got outside.
Bach lit a cigarette.
"It isn't. I know. Women move faster than this."
"Indeed.
That is unskilled labor."
Kati laughed again. The humor vanished, and the commander became serious.
"It's a pity."
"Yes, it is. They have all served us well."
"When?" "Very soon."
Kati paused.
"Gunther, your part in the plan. It is very dangerous."
Bach took a long pull on his cigarette, blowing the smoke out into the chilled air.
"It is my plan, is it not? I know the risks."
"I do not approve of suicidal plans," Kati observed after a moment.
"Nor do I. It is dangerous, but I expect to survive. Ismail, if we wanted a safe life, we would be working in offices, and we would never have met. What binds us is the danger and the mission. I've lost my Petra, my daughters, but I still have my mission. I do not say that this is enough, but is it not more than most men have?"
Gunther looked up at the stars.
"I have thought often of this, my friend. How does one change the world? Not in safety. The safe ones, the timid ones, they benefit from our work. They rage at life, but they lack the courage to act. We are the ones who act. We take the risks. We face the danger. We deny ourselves for others. It is our task. My friend, it is far too late to have second thoughts."
"Gunther, it is easier for me. I am a dying man."
I know. He turned to look at his friend. We're all dying men. We've cheated death, you and I. Eventually death will win. And the death we face lies not in bed. You chose this path, and so did I. Can we turn back now? I cannot. But facing death is a hard thing.
That is true. Gunther flipped his cigarette into the dirt. But at least we have the privilege of knowing. The little people do not. In choosing not to act, they choose not to know. That is their choice. One can either be an agent of destiny or a victim of it. Everyone has that choice. Bach led his friend back in. We have made ours. Bundle 38, Fromm commanded as they entered. 38, Gohn acknowledged.
Yes, Commodore? Sit down, Harry. We need to talk over some things. Well, I have the crew already. The sonar troops are hot. Mancuso looked at his subordinate. At what point, he wondered, does a positive can-do attitude become a lie? I'm a little concerned with the transfer rate from your ship. Ricks didn't go defensive. Well, we had some guys with family concerns. No sense holding on to people whose minds are in the wrong place. A statistical blip. I had it happen once before.
I bet you did.
How's morale? Mancuso asked next. You've seen the results of our drills and exams. That must tell you something, Captain Ricks replied. Clever son of a bitch. Okay, let me make it clear, Harry. You had a run-in with Dr. Jones.
So?
So I talked with him about it.
How formal is this?
Informal as you like, Harry.
Fine.
Your Jones fellow is a pretty good technician, but he seems to have forgotten the fact that he left the Navy as an enlisted man. If he wants to talk to me as an equal, it would help if he'd bothered to accomplish something.
That man has a doctor's degree in physics from Caltech, Harry.
Ricks took on a puzzled expression.
So?
So he is one of the smartest people I know, and he was the best enlisted man I ever met.
That's fine. But if enlisted were as smart as officers, we'd pay them more.
It was the supreme arrogance of the statement that angered Bart Mancuso.
Captain, when I was driving Dallas and Jones talked, I listened. If life had worked out a little different, he'd be on his XO tour right now and on his way to command of a fast attack. Ron would have made a superb CO.
Ricks dismissed that.
We'll never know that, will we? I always figured that those who can do. Those who can't make excuses.
Okay, fine, he's a good technician. I don't dispute that. He did good work with my sonar department, and I'm grateful for that. But let's not get too excited. There are lots of technicians, and lots of contractors.
This was going nowhere, Mancuso saw. It was time to lay the law down.
Look, Harry, I'm catching rumbles about morale on your boat. I see that many transfer requests, and it tells me there might be a problem. So I nose around, and my impression is confirmed. You have a problem whether you know it or not.
That, sir, is bullshit. It's like the alcohol counseling weenies. People with no drinking problems say they have no drinking problem, but the counselors say that denial of a problem is the first indication there is one. It's a circular argument. If I had a morale problem on my boat, performance figures would show it. But they don't. My record is pretty clear. I drive submarines for a living. I've been in the top 1% of the top 1% since I put this suit on. Okay, my style isn't the same as the next guy's. I don't kiss butt, and I don't mollycoddle. I demand performance, and I get it. You show me one hard indicator that I'm not doing it right, and I'll listen. But until you do, sir, it isn't broke, and I'm not going to try and fix it.
Bartolomeo Vito Mancuso, Captain,
Rear Admiral Selecti, United States Navy, did not come out of his chair only because his mainly Sicilian ancestry had been somewhat diluted in America. In the old country, he was instantly sure, his great-great-grandfather would have leveled his lupara and blown a wide, bloody hole through Rick's chest for that. Instead, he kept his face impassive and coldly decided on the spot that Rick's would never get beyond captain's rank. It was in his power to do that. He had a large collection of COs working for him. Only the top two, maybe the top three, would screen for flag rank. Rick's would be rated no higher than fourth in that group.
It might be dishonest, Mancuso told himself in a moment of dispassionate integrity, but it was still the right thing to do. This man could not be trusted with command higher than he now held, and he had probably come too far already. It would be so easy. Rick's would object loudly and passionately to being rated fourth in a group of 14, but Mancuso would simply say, "Sorry, Harry. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with you, just that Andy, Bill, and Chuck are a little better. Just bad luck to be in a squadron of aces, Harry. I have to make an honest call, and they're just a whisker better." Rick's was just fast enough to realize that he had crossed over a line, that there really were no off-the-record talks in the Navy. He had defied his squadron commander, a man already on the fast track, a man trusted and believed by the Pentagon and the OPPO2 bureaucracy. "Sir, excuse me for being so positive. It's just that nobody likes to be called down when..." Mancuso smiled as he cut the man off. "No problem, Harry. We Italians tend to be a little passionate, too." "Too late, Harry. Maybe you're right. Let me think it over. Besides, if I tangle with that Akula, I'll show you what my people can do." "Little late to talk about my people, fella." But Mancuso had to give him the chance, didn't he? Not much of a chance, but a little one. If there were a miracle, then he might reconsider. "Might," Bart told himself, "if this arrogant little prick decides to kiss my ass at the main gate at noon on the 4th of July while the marching band passes by." "Sessions like this are supposed to be uncomfortable for everybody," the squadron commander said. Rick's would end up as an engineering expert, and a good one, once Mancuso got rid of him. And there was no disgrace in topping out as a captain, was there? Not for a good man, anyway. "Nothing else?" Golovko asked.
"Not a thing," the colonel replied. "And our officer?" "I saw his widow 2 days ago. I told her that he was dead, but that we were unable to recover the body. She took the news badly. It is a hard thing to see so lovely a face in tears," the man reported quietly. "What about the pension, other arrangements?" "I am seeing to it myself." "Good. Those damned paper pushers don't seem to care about anyone or anything. If there's a problem, let me know." "I have nothing more to suggest from the technical intelligence side," the colonel went on. "Can you follow up elsewhere?" "We're still rebuilding our network inside their defense ministry. Preliminary indications are that there is nothing, that the new Germany has disavowed the whole DDR project," Golovko said. "There is a hint that American and British agencies have made similar inquiries and come away satisfied." "It is unlikely, I think, that German nuclear weapons would be a matter of immediate concern to the Americans or the English." "True. We are carrying on, but I do not expect to find anything. I think this is an empty hole." "In that case, Sergei Nikolaevich, why was our man murdered?"
"We still don't know that, damn it."
"Yes, I suppose he might now be working for the Argentinians. Colonel, remember your place." "I have not forgotten. Nor have I forgotten that when someone troubles to murder an intelligence officer, there is a good reason for it."
"But there's nothing there.
At least three intelligence services are looking. Our people in Argentina are still working.
Oh, yes. The Cubans.
Correct. That was their area of responsibility, and we can scarcely depend on their assistance now, can we?
The colonel closed his eyes. What had KGB come to?
I still think we should press on.
Your recommendation is noted. The operation is not over.
Exactly what he could do now, Golovko thought after the man left. Exactly what new avenues he should explore. He didn't know. He had a goodly percentage of his field force sniffing for leads, but as yet there was nothing. This miserable profession was so much like police work, wasn't it?
Marvin Russell went over his requirements. Certainly these were generous people. He still had almost all of the money he'd brought over. He'd even offered to make use of it, but Cotty would have none of that. He had a briefcase in which were $40,000 in crisp 20s and 50s, and on setting himself up in America, he'd take in a direct bank transfer from an English bank. His tasks were fairly simple. First, he needed new identities for himself and the others. That was child's play. Even doing the driver's licenses was not difficult if you had the right hardware, and he'd be purchasing that for cash. He'd even be able to set the equipment up in the safe house. Now, exactly why he had to do hotel reservations in addition to setting up the safe house was another question. These characters sure like to keep things complicated. On the way to the airport, he'd taken a day to stop at a good tailor shop. Beirut might have been at war, but life still went on. By the time he boarded the British Airways jet for Heathrow, he looked quite distinguished. Three very nice suits, two of them packed. A conservative haircut, expensive shoes that cramped his feet.
"Magazine, sir?" the stew asked.
"Thank you." Russell smiled.
"American?"
"That's right. Going home."
"It must be rather difficult in Lebanon."
"Did get kind of exciting, yes."
"Drink?"
"A beer would be very nice." Russell grinned. He was even getting the businessman lingo down. The plane was not even a third full, and it seemed like this stewardess was going to adopt him. Maybe it was the tan, Russell thought.
"There you go, sir. Will you be staying long in London?"
"Afraid not. Connecting to Chicago. 2-hour layover."
"That is too bad."
She even looked disappointed for him. The Brits, Russell thought, sure were nice people. Almost as hospitable as those Arabs. The last bundle went in just after 3 in the morning local time. Frome didn't alter his demeanor a dot. He checked this one as carefully as he had checked the first, fixing it in place only after he was fully satisfied. Then he stood straight up and stretched.
"Enough." "I agree, Manfred. This time tomorrow we'll have the assembly finished. What remains is simple, not 14 hours' work."
"In that case, let's get some sleep."
On the way out of the building, Gone gave the commander a wink. Cotty watched them depart, then walked over to the senior guard.
"Where's Ahmed?" "Went to see the doctor, remember?" "When's he back?"
"Tomorrow. Maybe the day after. I'm not sure."
"Very well. We will have a special job for you soon."
The guard watched the men walking away from the building and nodded dispassionately.
"Where do you want us to excavate the hole?"
Chapter 28. Contractual Obligations. Jet lag could be a real bitch, Marvin thought. Russell had left O'Hare in a rented Mercury and driven west to a motel just east of Des Moines. He surprised the clerk by paying cash for his room, explaining that his wallet and credit cards had been stolen. He had an obviously brand new wallet to support that statement, besides which the clerk honored cash as readily as any businessman. Sleep came easily that night. He awoke just after 5, after a good 10 hours of slumber, had himself a big American breakfast. As hospitable as people were in Lebanon, they didn't know how to eat. He wondered how they managed to live without bacon, and set off for Colorado. By lunch, he was halfway across Nebraska and going over his plans and requirements again. Dinner found him in the town of Rose.